Well, we are turning back to Job to read together again today. We're going to be covering all of Job 4 and 5 today, but I'm going to read just chapter 4 with you and start to listen in to Job's friends as they start to talk to him and empty their minds and hearts to him. So Job chapter 4, from the beginning. Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, "If someone ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? But who can keep from speaking? Think how you have instructed many, how you have strengthened feeble hands. Your words have supported those who stumbled. You have strengthened faltering knees. But now trouble comes to you and you're discouraged. It strikes you and you're dismayed. Should not your piety be your confidence and your blameless ways your hope? Consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. At the breath of God, they are destroyed. At the blast of his anger, they perish. The lions may roar and growl, yet the teeth of the great lions are broken. The lion perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. A word was secretly brought to me. My ears caught a whisper of it. Amid disquieting dreams in the night, when deep sleep falls on men, fear and trembling seized me and made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face, and the hair on my body stood on end. It stopped, but I could not tell what it was. A form stood before my eyes, and I heard a hushed voice. Can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? If God places no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who live in houses of clay, whose foundations are in the dust, who are crushed more readily than a moth. Between dawn and dusk, they are broken to pieces, unnoticed. They perish forever. Are not the cords of their tent pulled up so that they die without wisdom?" Well, lots of interesting, some strange thoughts there. And we'll look to God to address our hearts to all that Eliphaz had to say during that period of time. Well, with the London Marathon on today and the Olympics not too far away, you'll be expecting lots of illustrations from the athletic world over the next wee while, and we'll try and not disappoint you. So in a sense, during the first three chapters of Job, we had been limbering up. We've just been getting the exercises of our mind warmed up, ready for the big race ahead. And as we start chapter 4 onwards, we're into the race itself, running hectically at a speed unaccustomed to most of us, of about two chapters, sometimes even three chapters a week. I think David would be so surprised at this that he'll be coming back through the whole of May and June just to see how much I cope with two or three chapters per week. But as I said at the start, we need to take the whole book as a whole, and yet it is quite a long, difficult section from chapter 4 through to about chapter 30. And even trying to do chapters 4 and 5 together will be fairly hectic today. And I've warned Paul, he needs to be on his toes today, and if he's not, he'll get left far behind somewhere. But I do appreciate both Dom and Paul doing the slides for today, if there's quite a lot. Before we get to that, let me remind you of what we said about Job's friends. They were his friends. They'd traveled a long distance, they'd been sacrificial, they'd been highly motivated to journey to be with him, and they sat for a whole week without a word between them as they shared his agony and his pain. They are deeply distressed along with him. They felt shocked as they saw him physically deteriorated. They felt speechless as they tried to understand all that Job has gone through in his own personal physical pain, in the loss of his children, the loss of his possessions and his livestock. And these were just ordinary guys. They were not trained psychotherapists. They predated most of our Bible as we know it today. Nobody knows exactly when they came on the scene, but the guess is that Job and these men lived somewhere in the same era as Abraham. So they didn't have all the Old Testament and certainly none of the New Testament as we have it to guide them in their thinking. They simply come to try and help Job through his difficult times. Job himself has been introduced to us by God as the godliest man on earth. But Job himself is still struggling to try and come to terms with all that's happened to him and try and understand what lies ahead in the future. So we have Eliphaz and his friends and Job all struggling with big, big issues. Issues that, if we're honest, still baffle us. With all the information, with all the experience, with all the theology we have, we still come to Job and struggle to grapple with all that's going on. So when we listen to Eliphaz today and hear what he's saying, what he's doing, let's not be too hard on him. A couple of Sunday nights ago, I made reference to the elephant in the room, that kind of sense of a big, big issue that overshadows everything else. And with my childish humor, I did think of calling today the Eliphaz in the room, but I thought it was maybe a bit too much for Sunday morning for some of you. But I think in a sense, we'll identify with Eliphaz. We'll sense there's an Eliphaz in the room here today, and it's all of us. Because at some point or other in life, either with family, friends, fellow church members or acquaintances, we sit with people like Job. And we try and help them come to terms with what's going on in their lives. And we try and say the right thing or do the right thing. And perhaps at the end of the day, like this Eliphaz, we go away thinking, oh dear, I messed that one up. So I want to begin today by looking at the conclusions that Eliphaz brought to Job. Job had sat with his men, and Eliphaz had watched what was going on. He tried to take it all in. And then he comes to Job, and as he begins to talk, he has a number of conclusions about the whole situation that he wants to share with Job. The first one is in verses 3 to 6 of chapter 4. Conclusion: you need to practice what you preach. It doesn't actually say that in so many words, but it's very firmly there in those verses. He recalls how Job himself has been a wise encourager of other people through the past. People have come to Job, and he's been there to help them, to encourage them, to strengthen the weak knees, as the phrase goes. And now Eliphaz turns to Job and says, you know what, Job? It's time to take your own medicine. How come you could put other folks on the right road, you could comfort other folks, and now when trouble comes to you, you're dismayed, you're discouraged, you're down at heart, you're puzzled, and you're crying out to God, I wish I'd never been born. Come on, Job. Time to quit moaning and put your own theories into practice. As with all of these conclusions that Eliphaz arrived at, there are grains of truth in them, and there are some big gaps of theory as well. But I'm sure that as Eliphazes, we've all come alongside folks at some stage or other in life and said something similar. You know what? You've been a brilliant encourager of others. You've spoken great words of comfort to others. You know, just put that into practice yourself. And that's the first conclusion that Eliphaz arrives at. Conclusion number two is in verses 7 to 11, which I've summarized as, you reap what you sow. Eliphaz, of course, is not quoting scripture when he says this to Job. It's not been written anywhere else in scripture. He hadn't got a New Testament. He hadn't got an Old Testament. He probably had very little awareness of God's revelation anywhere written down. Although we have to say later, it became a very important Bible principle. Both the Old and New Testaments take this up as a spiritual principle in life, as well as an ordinary fact of life. There's that principle that if you sow righteousness, you reap righteousness. If you sow evil, you reap evil. When Paul writes to the Corinthians, he encourages them to make sure they sow that which is worthwhile and lasting and spiritual, and not sow the tares and the wheat and the rubbish stuff. So it is an important Bible principle, but that's not where Eliphaz draws this from. He draws it from his own personal experience. In chapter 4, verse 8, he uses this phrase, as I have observed. And in chapter 5, verse 3, I myself have seen. And Eliphaz is best typified in each of his speeches as the one who advises and concludes things for Job out of his own experience. We find the other friends have a slightly different take on things. Eliphaz's strength is, you know what, Job? I've seen things. I've been there. I've done things. And that's why I can conclude what I conclude. And experience often is a precious help and gift to us. But there are dangers. We'll say more of that later. But here he concludes, you reap what you sow, and it's what he's seen in his life. He's watched the farmers who sow wheat and they reap wheat. They don't sow wheat and reap carrots. You sow what you reap. There's a correlation between the two. He even makes reference to the animal kingdom, the lions and the lionesses and the cubs. And his bottom line is, you get what you deserve. That's the kind of God we have. Conclusion number one, then, is you need to practice what you preach, Job. Second conclusion to Job is, Job, you reap what you sow. Third conclusion, and it's from chapter 4, verse 12, through to the seventh verse of chapter 5, is you have to expect trouble. Again, he's well back to his own experience in chapter 4, verses 12 to 21, in what is probably very odd language for us, but it seems to recount a dream that he's had. When other people are sleeping during the middle of the night, Eliphaz was awake and had this vivid sense of something, a spirit, a ghost, or something passing by him and speaking with him. And the core of that dream is expressed in verse 17. No one can be as righteous and as pure as God himself. So he says, you know what, Job, I had this experience in the past, whether it's the immediate past or the long distance past, we're not told. He says, I had this experience of someone passing by me in the middle of the night, and the message was, can anyone be as pure as God? Can anyone be as righteous as God? And of course, the implied answer is, no, nobody can. Builds on that further by saying, you know what, even the angels get told off by God for their errors. And that leads him to that belief that every human being who cannot be as righteous as God, who cannot be as pure as God, who are even worse behaved than the angels, are going to have trouble in life. And so 5 verse 7 gives us one of the memorable verses from Job's whole book. Man is born to trouble as surely as the sparks fly upward. So his language is simply, Job, you've got to expect trouble in this world. None of us are as pure as God. None of us are as righteous, righteous as God. We're all in this mess together. We're all in a fallen world. Job, you've just got to expect trouble to come your way. And you can almost sense that kind of wee niggle in Eliphaz's mind to Job as he's saying, basically, Job, you thought you had it made and nothing would ever trouble you. But Job, you should have known differently. Job, you should have known better. Job, you should have known that man is born to trouble as sure as the sparks fly upward. And instead of being puzzled about his troubles, Job should have been anticipating it all the way along. And like his other conclusions, there's a grain of truth there, but it's not the whole truth. Fourth conclusion, and in case you're wondering how many there are, there's five altogether, and then I want to critique them afterwards, so we've a long day ahead yet. But number four, you need to pray. Again, it's not exactly his words, but if you look at verse 7, Eliphaz has this wonderful word to Job. If it were I would appeal to God. So here's Eliphaz saying, you know what, Job? If I was in your situation, and I was going through all you've gone through, and I was bearing the burden that you're bearing, I would have gone and talked to God about it. I'd have appealed to God. As far as Eliphaz's experience is concerned, God is responsive to those who call on him. So in chapter 5, verses 7 to 16, he talks of the way God provides for all of creation. He talks the way in which God delivers those who call on him. He talks the way in which God saves and rescues those who rest in him. And so his conclusion, and he gives it to Job, is, you know what, Job? If you would depend on God, if you would appeal to God, if you would pray, then you'd find that God saves the needy. That's verse 15. And the implication, of course, is, Job, you haven't been doing that. And Job, if you just start doing it, then you'd find the answer to your dilemma and God would rescue you. Conclusion number five, and that's chapter 5, verses 17 to 27, is, Job, you have to accept God's discipline. His first discourse ends, as far as Eliphaz is concerned, by describing the wonderful restoration God is able to provide when suffering is over. And verses 24 to 26 contain some wonderful promises which he's passing on to Job in his distress. I'm not quite sure what Job would have made of them when you analyze them. Security is what God gives from the robbers. Here's the man who's sitting on the rubbish dump outside the city, full of pains and aches, who's seen robbers and thieves come and take away all of his possessions, these vast numbers of livestock, all the crops that were in the field. And Eliphaz says, you know what? God will provide protection from the robbers. God promises, according to Eliphaz, restoration of your property. So whatever you've lost, God can make it up to you. How painful the next words, where he promises that God can give you many children and vast numbers of descendants. Here's a man who's still in the middle of grief for losing 10 children. And here's someone coming along, slapping on the back. You know what, Job? God's able to make you have lots and lots more children. In the last part of those verses, God promises long life, so you reach the grave in full strength. They're quite strange promises that Eliphaz wants to conclude in Job's mind. We might run to the end of the book and say, you know what? Eliphaz was right. God did all those things. But my sense, they're probably the wrong thing to say to somebody who's right in the darkest moment of their grief and sorrow. What makes it worse is in this conclusion, verse 17, as far as Eliphaz is concerned, the key to enjoying all those promises is to accept God's discipline and correction. That's all Job needs to do. If he simply say, God, I've messed up, I've gone wrong, I've failed you, I've disappointed you, and you've been punishing me and chastising me with all these experiences, then God will make all the promises come real to you. Eliphaz's final shot, verse 27, kind of the way to conclude it all is, you know what, Job? We, that's Eliphaz and his mates, we've been contemplating this, we've thought it all through, as if saying, no, we know this is right. We've got all our combined experience together. So come on, Job, take our conclusions to heart and just start living it out. You need to practice what you preach. You reap what you sow. You have to expect trouble. You need to pray. You have to expect and accept God's discipline and correction. If we take a breather there for a minute, we might ask ourselves, have we ever used any of those arguments, either to others or to ourselves? I'm not asking you to put your hand up, I'm not asking you to tell me afterwards, but I'm saying I know my heart and I know the experience of many people. They get a bad report from the doctors, and immediately their thought is, God is disciplining me. I must have done something wrong. Something is bad in life, business fails, and immediately the thought is, oh well, you reap what you sow. If my business has gone bad, it was either bad judgment or bad mistake or bad failure of my own in the past. A relation cracks up, and in our hearts we say, well, man's born to trouble as the sparks fly upwards. I should have expected that. That's just how things are in life. And the worst of all is when you have encouraged or preached to others and trouble comes to your doorstep in one shape or form, and really the kind of argument comes, well, you ought to be able to practice what you preach. You've helped others, so therefore it should be automatic and simple for you to help yourself. Five conclusions that Eliphaz had as he speaks these words to Job. Second main heading, and you'll be glad to know there's only two main headings today, are the mistakes mingled with truth. As I said earlier, each of the conclusions we've listened to does have an element of truth in it. You can take each of those conclusions and work your way through Old and New Testaments and find supporting evidence for those arguments. But each of them, as Eliphaz speaks them to Job, has some element of mistake in it as well. I try to categorize them by saying, first of all, mistake number one is replacing love with logic. And something that runs through the whole the rest of this book of Job. Each of Job's friends try to help Job by applying careful doses of logical, clear thought to Job's suffering. The kind of mentality is, if we just get the right argument into Job's head, he'll be better. It's most visible in that first conclusion, you need to practice what you preach. There's some truth there. It's very logical. You simply say, fact number one, Job, your words have helped troubled people. Fact. Fact number two, if you apply your words to yourself, you'll help yourself in your own experience of trouble. That sounds clear, logical, correct. But that logic is not the whole truth. The truth was, it wasn't the words of Job alone that enabled people to be helped by Job. It was the Job behind the words who had helped people in the past. It wasn't that Job got a textbook out and found a little series of phrases and sound bites and just put them in people's ears and logically argued them and that helped them. It was that Job, as a person, as a caring, loving person, had sat down beside people and shared with them through the dark times. It was a Job behind the words, not just the words themselves, that accounted. We all know this, in fact. an experience perhaps. Someone's in bed in hospital and two loving Christians go in to minister to that person, and both of them quote Romans 8 verse 28, all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to his purpose. The first one goes in icily cold in their logic to say to this person, get yourself out of your state of sadness and grief and annoyance and frustration and puzzlement. Here's a word of God for you, brother. God works all things together for them that love God and are called according to his purpose. Now, just apply that to yourself, would you? And get yourself up on your feet and put your socks up. The cold voice of logic. The other person goes and sits at the bedside and weeps with the person who's got the bad news. Enters into something of the feelings and fears and anxieties the person has. And then says, you know what? I can't get all of this verse myself. I don't understand how it applies in every situation. But I just want to leave you with these words before I go. God works all things together for good to them that love him and are called according to his purpose. And that loving expression of exactly the same words can leave the person warmed and comforted and strengthened. What Eliphaz had got into his head was, so long as I say the right things, it doesn't matter about how they're being communicated to the person who's listening. Eliphaz has spent a very helpful week with Job, comforting Job by the warmth of his presence. But when he started to exchange love for cold logic, he actually added to Job's pain. We might ask, what changed Eliphaz? In fact, what had changed all three men from week one, where they sat in silence alongside Job on the ash heap? What changed that into starting to talk and talk and talk and talk to Job thereafter? Maybe he just ran out of patience. Maybe he felt he could fix things for Job. We're all great fixers in life. And if we think we have the right key, the right answer, the right solution to fix things for people, well, we all love to do that. My guess is actually with Eliphaz is just he couldn't cope with Job's words. So in the opening of chapter 4, you have that kind of phrase, well, how can we keep silent? Because in the previous chapter, Job has spoken. And the things that Job had said seemed to demand a response from Eliphaz. Job had cursed the day he was born. He wished he'd never been born. He wished he could go into the beauties of what lies beyond death. Remember all that powerful, painful chapter. And so instead now of being able to sit and just listen to Job and listen to Job's hurt, what Eliphaz does is say, I've got an argument for you. I've got something to say back to you. More of that in a minute. Mistake number two is over-reliance on the power of reason. His conclusion all display a good level of rational argument. We reap what we sow, we're born to trouble, we need to pray, we need to accept discipline. All that's rational, clear, straightforward argument. Not just rationally accurate, but we might say theologically accurate as well. It all reflects biblical teaching one place or another. But I think where Eliphaz has gone wrong is in thinking he's taken everything into account. Eliphaz and his mates all seem to think, I've got this sussed, I've covered all my bases, I've exhausted all possible avenues of approach to Job's problems. Eliphaz seems to be the oldest man, the more mature one. He's got all this wealth of experience. He's been round all the corners of life. He thinks he has all the possible combinations of answers to Job's situation. But I think Eliphaz trusted his own reason too much. Was Eliphaz right in thinking that Job had not tried to encourage himself with the same kinds of words that he'd encouraged other people through the past? I think when we come to Job's responses later on, we find that Job had done that. He tried. He tried day after day after day to take the truths and helps you provided for other people and apply them to himself, but it wasn't working. But all Eliphaz can say is practice what you preach. Was Eliphaz right in assuming that Job had not appealed to God? Remember that phrase, you know, if it were I would have appealed to God. And the implication is, come on, Job, you haven't started properly praying yet. Was that right? I think it was. And again, as you go through the rest of the book, we find that Job's problem was not that he hadn't been praying. His problem was he was praying. He was appealing to God. He was crying out, oh, that my Redeemer would stand now so I could see him and know what he was about. But the problem was God hadn't replied to that appeal. What Eliphaz was saying seems to have reason behind it. Call out to God, pray to God, and he'll fix things for you. But actually, that was wrong reasoning. We know from what we've seen in chapters 1 and 2 already that actually Eliphaz had missed one great big possibility altogether. He hadn't even thought of this one. That the reason Job's suffering is that in the councils of eternity, Satan and God have had a challenge match. And God has said, have you ever seen anyone like Job, my servant? He will never give up on me, no matter what you do to him. And Satan said, I would just take away some of the blessings, some of the possessions, some of the joys of life, inflict him with pain, and he'll curse you. And that's what's going on. Eliphaz hasn't even thought of that as a possibility. Of course, poor Job hadn't thought of that either. And we knew it. Not because some of us have sat down as brilliant theologians and worked out possibilities that Eliphaz hadn't worked out. We know it because God has revealed it to us. Don't get me wrong, we do have rational minds, and God expects us to use them. God has created this world, this universe, as a reasonable, rational, ordered place and expects us to treat it as such. The Bible can call our faith a reasonable, a rational faith. We're called to give God our rational, our reasonable service of worship to him in Romans 12. The problem is when we start to lean on our reason too much and think to ourselves we know all there is to know. The truth is that same God who's made us that way keeps reminding us how limited we are. God's ways are higher than our ways, and his thoughts higher than our thoughts. God simply thinks on a different level to what any human being can ever do. Worse than believing in the infallibility of the Pope is in believing in the infallibility of our reason. God's ways are past finding out. And Eliphaz just hasn't got that. He still believes that human reason can get everything sorted. I don't want you to keep rushing to the end of Job to remind yourself how it all finishes off, because part of our experience is suffering alongside of Job in the waiting period. But if I did rush you towards the end, I'd take up the words of Job at the end when he concluded, "Surely I spoke things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know." And one of the big lessons of the whole book of Job is that lesson. That human logic, human reason, and human knowledge are not the whole story. We simply don't have the mental capacity to take in all that God knows and all that God is doing. And instead of over-relying on the power of our reason, Sometimes we simply have to throw ourselves back in the arms of a loving God and say, your ways are not my ways, your thoughts are not mine. Third and final mistake is hearing argument instead of hurt. We ask what changed Eliphaz and suggest it might have been Job's words, that when Job says what he says in chapter 3, Eliphaz says, well, I better correct him. He's gone away offline there. How dare anyone say I curse the day I was born? And I think if we were all in that same position, we'd all be Eliphaz's in the room. We'd all jump in as well, just as quickly to correct this terrible statement that Job has just made. He acts in doing so as though what Job really needs is a debate, a discussion, an argument, something that would set him right in his thinking, a really good talking to. In fact, all the way through this book, the debate that takes place shows each of his friends doing the same. What Job really needs is a good talking to. He needs to get his thinking sorted out correctly. But what Job really needed was someone to listen to him, to hear behind the words the hurt that was still deep in Job's mind and being. Eliphaz never got what was really troubling Job. Eliphaz and his friends never understood that what Job was wrestling with was not the pain, not the sorrow, not the loss. What Job was wrestling with was, why is God allowing this to happen? But they didn't hear that. All they wanted was a good argument to sort him out. People in grief, people in sorrow, people in extreme pain rarely express themselves well. Rarely express themselves with theological accuracy. But they don't need someone to put that right. They need to hear the hurt that's underneath. Dealing with those we care about in life is not about answering all the things they say. It's about detecting the hurt, the loss, the sadness, the puzzlement, and trying to show we understand that with them, even if we can't answer it for them. We help them best not by paying meticulous attention to our clever argument, but by paying meticulous attention to the hurt they feel and showing we care about it. I love the way in which the New Testament has pictures of Jesus in similar situations and how he handles people. I was thinking during the week of the parable of the prodigal son. And the son has taken all his possessions, he's gone off into the far country, he's lived a ridiculously evil, rampant, self-centered life. He's feeding the pigs. He decides to go home. Initially, he's decided to go home not because he accepts he's a terrible failure, a terrible sinner, he's treated his father badly. He wants to go home because he hasn't got anything left to eat. And he heads home. And in Jesus' story, the father is waiting for him. What does a father do? Does he start to give him a lecture? Really, I warned you before you ever went off, son, that if you behave like that, you won't get back here again. Does he give him a theological expose of that natural depravity that has manifested itself in his life? Now, son, I want you to understand your natural depravity. I want you to understand that the process of redemption and forgiveness. I want you to understand how atonement will take place. And when you've passed your theological degree, I'll let you come back home again. Does Jesus, in his picturing of this father, suggest a debate on the causes of human disaffection in family life? does he call for his son to exact some kind of repayment for all that's happened? Does he have a discussion about the son's willingness and readiness to act in his father's house as one of his hired servants rather than fully as a son? No, he throws his arms around him and welcomes him back home. Loved him, cared for him. And that's not a human story. It's Christ's own picturing of how God treats those who've messed up in life. Both as sufferers and sympathizers, we have a lot to learn from Eliphaz, haven't we? He had some brilliant conclusions, but there was a little thread of human mistake running through them all. But as I finish this morning, I simply want to say, don't knock Eliphaz. For Eliphaz is in the room. He's me and he's you. He's people trying to help others as best we can in our limited way. And we thank God that Eliphaz was trying when others hadn't even bothered to come.